welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 9th, 2021. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. From the front page of today's Gazette, a mission for motherhood, Hiawatha family to adopt three Ukrainian boys after numerous delays. By Elijah Decius of the Gazette. To some moms, motherhood must go beyond the duty of raising the kids who already are at home. For Jenna Breckenridge, it's a mission to bring the children she knows are hers home safely from more than 5,000 miles away. Another Mother's Day is passing with Jenna and her husband Scott separated from their soon-to-be adopted boys in Ukraine, 16-year-old twin brothers Ilya and Bogdan, and 10-year-old Mykola. In a mix of Ukrainian and English conversations, "I miss you and I love you" over video calls are words the twins tell Jenna daily to hold her over until they reach the destination in their long journey of adoption. The Breckenridge residence in Hiawatha, and nothing will stop her from bringing them home. Ilya and Bogdan started calling them Mom and Dad on day two, after they first met through an arrangement the parents had no idea would lead to adoption. "We weren't even supposed to host them," said Jenna, when the couple signed up for a program that brings Ukraine orphans to the United States for a stay. "We were supposed to host another boy, and their orphanage pulled away from the agency we were using for hosting. We didn't even know at the beginning of this hosting thing that adoption is kind of what eventually happens." As soon as the twins walked through the terminal doors at the airport, that changed. "I was just running to them, and Scott's behind me," Jenna said. "We're keeping them, aren't we?" Scott asked. "Yes," Jenna said, sobbing as she embraced the boys she knew were their children. It's a primal instinct that Jenna, with two children already in Iowa, can't quite explain. Before meeting the twins, the Breckenridges knew only their first names and ages. "There's really no words," she said. "You just knew. It's a feeling." Despite being separated since they last saw the twins before the pandemic, those feelings have carried them through the majority of their relationship experience through video calls with sometimes spotty connections. But more importantly, it has fueled their drive to adopt the boys at any cost, overcoming roadblocks along the way. In the adoption process, Jenna and Scott already have gone through three adoption agencies. The first was shut down, putting the Breckenridges back at square one, losing thousands of dollars in fees and an entire year of work. The second was one they left voluntarily after getting the idea the agency might not always be acting in their best interests. Now cutting through red tape and administrative rejections has made them paranoid, down to making sure they use the same shade of white paper when printing out paperwork, aligning stamps perfectly on documents, and ensuring they literally cross every T and dot every I. "Everything has to be in blue ink," Scott said. One document was invalidated because the notary didn't use a middle name in the signature. "We've had literally every roadblock imaginable," Jenna said. "It's just been a wild ride." One rejection put them on the verge of being unable to adopt the children at all, with a filing rejection returned a mere month before the twins' 16th birthday, the deadline for one U.S. citizenship and immigration services requirement. Their agency offered them $26 for the fault in the rejection, giving the wrong fee information. "We almost lost our kids, and they're like, here's $26, Scott said. When all is said and done, the family will have spent about $55,000 in fees and expenses to adopt the three boys. Their story has managed to touch local donors who have helped out in ways big and small. After finishing ninth grade, Ilya and Bogdan aged out of the orphanage system in Ukraine. They've been living in a hostel ever since, waiting for their last hope to leave a country in which they see no future. When they're orphans, they'll forever be stamped as an orphan," Jenna explained. "They'll always carry that title on their IDs. With that title comes severe restrictions on ever being able to leave the country," she said. The brothers have been orphaned since age 8. Jenna and Scott still aren't sure what happened to their biological parents. "I don't know, but they drank a lot," is all they've been told by the twins. Mykola, a 10-year-old with special needs, doesn't yet know there's a family coming for him. Scott and Jenna will leave for Ukraine in June, where Jenna will spend 2 months to finalize adoptions. But she says the drive to adopt likely won't stop with the three boys, pushed by the urge to get loving children out of difficult situations to a family that will return the love. "To give them a mom and dad that loves them, just a family, something they don't have and they've never experienced," Scott said. "Family means love to me," said Ilya. "When I arrived in Iowa, I finally understood. For me, family are people who appreciate, love, respect, support you, and spend a good time together," said Bogdan. "I can't explain it either, but I know Jenna and Scott are my mom and dad." For Jenna, it's the desire to give others the mother that she never had. "I love my dad, but my mom's not in the picture. I just didn't have parents growing up," she said. "For me, parents are everything." That drive has acted as a catalyst, turning the woman who originally didn't want children into a mom, stepmother, and adoptive mother to three boys. and the parents will do whatever it takes to bring the last three home, fighting to be reunited with the boys as if she birthed them herself by selling household possessions, working overtime, and pinching pennies in between numerous adoption steps. Because no matter how it happened, Ilya, Bogdan, and Mykola are their children. And there's a photograph accompanying this story. From their hostel in Ukraine, twin brothers Bogdan and Ilya talk on a video call May 3rd with their soon-to-be adopted father, Scott Breckenridge, who joins them from his living room in Hiawatha. Scott is holding a blue iPad with the boys, one of them full face center in the screen and the other one peeking his head over the shoulder. Well, it looks like Jenna is sitting next to Scott, petting the family dog. Also from the front page of today's Gazette, 5 years of managed care in Iowa and criticism continues. Medicaid patients say they still are seeing services cut, by Michaela Ram of the Gazette. Years after privatization, there's still a deep divide in Iowa when it comes to the state's Medicaid program. This year marks the fifth anniversary since Iowa overhauled its Medicaid program, moving it from a state-run system to a managed care model that handed the reins over to private out-of-state insurance companies. Today, the $5 billion program administers health care benefits to more than 700,000 poor and disabled Iowans a year. The program has stabilized since the tumultuous rollout and the upheavals in the years since, according to state leadership, allowing them to focus on improving health outcomes of Iowans on Medicaid. "We're not having the same type of conversations we were 4 or 5 years ago," Iowa Medicaid Director Elizabeth Matney said in a Gazette interview. Matney, who was recently appointed to the role, will start June 1st. And according to Kelly Garcia, director of Iowa's Department of Human Services, the managed care program is accomplishing what officials set out to do when they switched to managed care, improving the health of Iowans and saving the state money. "We are stable," Garcia said. Despite that, criticism of the program has not stopped. Complaints from providers about lower reimbursement are reminiscent of the same complaints voiced 4 and 5 years ago. Advocates say Medicaid members, particularly those who require long-term supports, struggle to obtain the care they need. "Iowans were made more vulnerable by privatization," said Jen Wolf, a disability advocate behind the hashtag Upgrade Medicaid initiative. Garcia said the department still is hearing those concerns, but emphasized the program is in a better place even than what it was a year ago. "That happens, but it is not what was occurring even when I arrived in the state 8 months ago," she said, "and we've seen a signal from DHS that we have a focus on holding our managed care organizations accountable." Garcia came to Iowa in November 2019 after working in a variety of roles with the Health and Human Services Commission in Texas. Some opponents of the state's managed care program continue to question the claim that the switch from a government-run Medicaid system to a privatized model is saving the state money, first stated by then-Governor Terry Branstad. During comments on the Senate floor ahead of the 5-year milestone, State Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat Des Moines, said the program has cost taxpayers millions, while the insurance companies handling the program have seen major profits in a state fiscal year 2020 and 2021. According to the latest report, capitation payments to the managed care organizations amounted to $1.36 billion for the second quarter of state fiscal year 2021. "We were promised savings and promised better access to services and better health for Iowans. That's not true," Peterson told the Gazette. State leadership has disagreed with the claim that it has no data to prove the program is saving money. "For years, we've been pushing data out, but we could do a better job explaining the so what question," Matney said. "The state is saving money compared to the previous program," Garcia said to the Gazette this past week. Her department is making a renewed push to enhance its data collection systems, including one that's more than 40 years old, to increase accessibility and ease of use for employees and for the public. "The system doesn't have a shortage of data. It's really the ease and availability," said Garcia, who also acts as director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. "I think our providers, our clients, legislators, our full spectrum of stakeholders don't see us using that information in the way they like, and I think that internally we don't have what we would like," she said. "So we're building that." However, state officials have not specified how much money the state is saving when compared to the previous state-run program. Then-Medicaid Director Michael Randall, who left the position in August, stated the switch to managed care had saved the state $140.9 million for fiscal year 2018, which conflicted with earlier estimates that put savings at a low figure. "The switch to managed care didn't happen without what one state official at the time described as bumps in the road. Even before the switch, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention stepped in to delay the transition over concerns about the state's readiness. Federal health officials gave their approval in early 2016, and the program switched management on April 1st of that year. Challenges continued to plague the program. Managed care organizations left the program due to what they described as chronic underfunding, starting with the exit of American Health Caritas in late 2017, and followed by United Healthcare of the River Valley in 2019. Two managed care organizations, Amerigroup and Iowa Total Care, currently manage the program. State officials say a third insurer may be brought into the program as they approach contract negotiations for Amerigroup, whose current contract is scheduled to expire in mid-2023. But the abrupt exits of those previous insurers resulted in upheavals for Medicaid member services, patients, and advocates, say. Early on, Iowans claimed they were denied necessary health care, and providers complained they failed to receive full or partial reimbursement for their services. At one stage, the Iowa Ombudsman's Office assigned a full-time staff member to respond to Iowans' complaints about the managed care program, Ombudsman Christy Hirschman said in 2017. Now, 5 years later, some Iowans say they aren't able to get the services they need from the managed care organizations. For Garrett Fry, a quadriplegic who relies on a ventilator to breathe, it's been a challenge to get the in-home nursing to help with his personal care needs. As a result, he's had to rely more on his mother to fill the gaps, which he said has taken a heavy toll on his family. I have a great support system, but I do not know where I'd be without them, said Fry, who also serves on the City of Cedar Rapids ADA Advisory Committee. But I do not feel my mom should feel compelled to be my primary caregiver or any of my family. Hashtag Upgrade Medicaid's Wolf said Fry is not the only member who believes they constantly are advocating for services they need. Reducing services for disabled Iowans and others that require 24-hour care will not improve their health, she said, but will raise costs for the managed care organizations. People are getting sick. They are having more physical symptoms and more mental health issues because of their level of stress, Wolf said. To continue addressing those complaints, the Department of Human Services Garcia said the department is adding staff to focus on issues that arise with both members and providers. Any big system is going to have some challenges. It's really important that we hear those and that we get to whether it was one-off or a systemic issue, she said. And also from the Gazette, nearly 36% of Iowans now fully vaccinated. Only one COVID-related death reported Saturday. The number of Iowans completely vaccinated against the novel coronavirus reached 1,133,842, or 35.94% of the population, as of 1:30 p.m. Saturday. That's 16,475 more residents than the day before, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data and as analyzed by the Gazette staff. Only one virus-related death was confirmed on Saturday from April 10th statewide. That was of a person between the ages of 41 and 60, the state said. The New York Times database listed 580,452 deaths nationwide as of early Saturday. Linn County was listed with 39.54% of its population having received a complete series of vaccines at 89,645 people. Johnson County reached 46.14% with 69,741 residents fully vaccinated. The New York Times estimated some 33% of the U.S. population had been fully vaccinated as of Saturday morning. The state reported 300 new cases of COVID-19 as of early Saturday afternoon for the previous 24-hour period. That takes the 7-day average to 339. Linn County was counted with 19 new cases, with a 7-day average of 23. Johnson County had 12 added cases, which took its 7-day average to 12. Children under the age of 18 saw 74 new cases, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data. Only one new case was recorded for adults working in the education sector. The number of Iowans hospitalized in connection with COVID-19 declined by 13 from Friday to 179. 39 patients were in intensive care units, 4 fewer than the previous day, while 16 remained on ventilators. Only one outbreak was included in Saturday afternoon's statewide tabulation, down 1 from Friday. That one outbreak, meaning the facility has recorded 3 or more positive cases of COVID-19 among residents or staff, was at Urbandale Health Care Center in Polk County. A roundup of some headlines, a recap of news from across the state and the week in Iowa from the Iowa Today section. Lawmakers pass ban on vaccine passports. Legislation banning vaccine passports in Iowa is on its way to Governor Kim Reynolds for her expected signature. The Iowa Senate voted to approve a bill that prohibits businesses, schools, and state and local government facilities from denying access to people who haven't had the COVID-19 vaccination. And all government entities in Iowa would be barred from issuing ID cards with a person's vaccination history. The legislation makes exceptions for healthcare facilities, such as hospitals, clinics, or nursing homes, and would not affect requirements that employers may place on their employees. Session dragging. A Republican stalemate over tax policy has the potential to drag out the 2021 session. Governor Kim Reynolds pitched a compromise package she hoped would break a stalemate, but House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican New Hartford, says there's no agreement yet. Transgender athletes. Governor Kim Reynolds defended as a fairness issue her call for a state law to prohibit transgender students from competing in sports with the gender with which they identify. Advocates for transgender students called such legislation hurtful, cruel, and wrong. Housing vouchers. Landlords will be allowed to deny leases to renters who rely on federal housing choice aid like Section 8 vouchers under a measure signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. They said, "It's just mind-boggling to me that Republicans can be this way. This was a legitimate election. Donald Trump tried to delegitimize the election." That was Dave Milaj, a former Scott County Republican Party chairman. "And to say that this proposed legislation might be a bad idea is a monumental understatement." That was Rob Roan, a driver's education teacher at Iowa Western Community College, on a bill to allow parents to teach their teenagers how to drive. Odds and ends. COVID strain, a coronavirus variant that was first identified in hard-hit India, has been uncovered in Iowa, state public health officials said. Officials still are learning about the characteristics of this variant, but it is not designated as a variant of concern. Spring planting. Favorable weather allowed Iowa farmers to plant almost half of this year's corn crop last week, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig said. Legal assistance. The Iowa Supreme Court approved $195,695 in grants to 11 nonprofit programs that provide legal assistance to low-income Iowans with civil legal problems. The water cooler, conservation funding. Farmers and landowners can sign up for state cost-share funds to help adopt soil health and water quality practices, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig said. Fish data. The Department of Natural Resources said Iowa anglers can now access fish survey data collected by staff of the DNR's fisheries during electroshocking and netting surveys on lakes, rivers, and streams. Iowa's economic indicators. Iowa's index of leading economic indicators jumped a record 1.3% in March, marking the eighth month of positive growth since the COVID-19 pandemic hit in March 2020. And more in the news. Interest divided over ethanol mandate. Farm interests, fuel retailers, and others whipsawed a state Senate panel over a legislative proposal seeking to push more use of renewable fuels that proponents hailed as an economic boon for Iowa-based industries and critics panned as a government intrusion that would cost drivers more at the pump. Governor Kim Reynolds introduced the bill to promote more ethanol and biodiesel sales in Iowa. House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican New Hartford, conceded to reporters the bill is a difficult push as the 2021 legislative session pushes toward adjournment. Vaccine hesitancy. Governor Kim Reynolds said 46% of eligible Iowans are fully vaccinated from COVID-19, but demand for the vaccine in Iowa continues to wane. 88 counties declined all or some of their new allocation of COVID-19 vaccine doses for this week. Second dose. Nearly a quarter of people who initiated the COVID-19 vaccine series in Iowa have missed their second dose, according to state public health officials, potentially throwing a wrench in the race toward herd immunity. And sexual assault, U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York who briefly ran for president in 2019, heaped praise on Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst for their support of Gillibrand's legislation aimed at reducing sexual assault in the military. And from the Iowa Today section, Todd Dorman's In Iowa column, Mom's gone, but still a source of inspiration. The last conversation I had with my mother was not profound. She was in the hospital in Belmond, my hometown. Her heart was failing, and she was set to be transported to Mason City. It was a random weekday afternoon in April 2010. "I'll be there as soon as I can," I said from my desk at the Gazette. "Okay," she said. Turns out she was being transferred by helicopter and coded on the flight. She was revived but was heavily sedated when I got to Mason City and would stay that way until she underwent surgery several days later. As we sat in the waiting room, a surgical nurse came to tell us they were having trouble getting her heart restarted after surgery. A little while later, they told us she was gone. So we wandered, stunned, into the parking lot on a beautiful spring evening. My dad, ever practical, was on his phone, talking with a friend who owns a funeral home in Belmond. My wife and I got in the car and headed back south. It was supremely ironic that it was my mother's heart that did her in, given how big and generous it was. Generosity was her trademark, whether you were one of her kids or grandkids or stray animals. When we visited, she'd sneak me a check before we left and wouldn't take no for an answer. She served us desserts bigger than our heads, and filled giant bags at Christmas with gifts bigger than the grandkids that received them. With generosity came fairness. Every bag had the same amount of gifts, down to the penny. She taught kindergarten for years and then ran a nursery school, as they called it then, for many years with a dear friend. In many ways, she still lives, sometimes through my keyboard. She threw in with underdogs and cats, taking them in, feeding them, taking them to the vet, and providing heat and shelter in the winter. Maybe that's why I feel the need to cry foul when politicians dump on the vulnerable and disadvantaged. Maybe it's the indignation she felt in the face of cruelty that helps pound my keystrokes. She once plopped down in the middle of a patch of violets out in our front yard to keep my dad from mowing over them. Maybe that's the spirit that causes me to spit nails when the politically powerful seek to defile our environment for profit. She taught kids because she loved them and saw education as important, not to make a lot of money. So when State House types start busting on public education, my mom and dad, who also spent his life in education, taught me to know better. They taught school before unions and remembered what it was like to work through the whims of capricious administrators. She wasn't overly political, although there is a good story about her staying up all night to see her candidate, John Kennedy, win in 1960, before waking up my dad to inform him his candidate, Richard Nixon, lost. But in the interest of bipartisanship, she also once shared a piece of wedding cake with Chuck Grassley. She was never convinced that journalism was my best bet. She saw the small paychecks and crappy apartments I lived in and heard my complaints during phone calls. She always reminded me that it's never too late to go to law school. And yet after she died, we found piles of newspapers and clippings she kept of stuff I wrote. She was always good at being simultaneously proud and worried. She also lives in my kids. My daughter Ella in particular shows regular flashes of Grandma. Ella loves music and performing just like my mother did as a child, even appearing in an old Hal Roach movie filmed in Mason City. Ella's angry stare can shoot fire like Mom's. Ella also has my mom's penchant for getting names, songs, and lyrics and pronunciations wrong. The kid who called bikinis zucchinis and ordered a Charlie Niblet instead of a Shirley Temple definitely has some Grandma Lee flowing in her veins. My dad, who is now 89 and in memory care, asks about her often. I usually tell him she's in a good place. And by that I mean still here with us. Turning to the inside page, Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column, American Governors of Freedom. The Iowa legislature is in overtime, scrambling to strike a compromise on a multi-billion dollar budget. It could be several more weeks, we're told. With real work yet to be done, Governor Kim Reynolds is calling on the legislature to spend time debating young Iowans' genitals. A bill to restrict transgender girls from participating in girls' sports is apparently a top priority for the governor. She didn't mention it during her Condition of the State address 5 months ago, but instead during a Fox News broadcast a week ago, after the legislature's targeted adjournment date. Reynolds' late addendum to the legislative agenda was part of a panel discussion among a select group of GOP governors on Laura Ingraham's primetime program. The forum was meant to highlight how the governors preserved our God-given freedoms during the pandemic, Ingraham said in the show's introduction. Reynolds and her peers delivered a topsy-turvy vision of freedom, one where you didn't have to wear a mask but where classroom speech is dictated by the government, social media companies are heavily regulated, and the contents of kids' underwear are subject to state-sanctioned inspection. Panelists lashed out at a federal proposal to increase legal protection for LGBTQ Americans. When the Mississippi governor boasted of being the first to sign legislation to protect female athletes, Reynolds jumped in to say she would do the same. We are working on legislation. I should have that on my desk by the end of this legislative session, and we will sign that bill, Reynolds said, drawing applause from the Florida audience. However, lawmakers aren't actually working on that issue. They introduced legislation to that effect early in the session, but never even hosted a subcommittee hearing. Under the proposal, which was dead until Reynolds ordered its revival, students of the male sex, including transgender girls, would be ineligible to participate in girls' sports. Such a policy is spiteful and unnecessary, but what's really enraging is a section on disputes of biological sex. To prove their biological sex, an athlete would have to get a signed statement from a doctor to verify their internal and external reproductive anatomy and normal, endogenously produced levels of testosterone. What constitutes a legitimate dispute? The legislation doesn't say. Anyone potentially could file a frivolous complaint to force a star athlete to go have their junk checked out at the doctor's office. It's a free country, after all. One of Reynolds' fellow GOP governors took issue with such infringements on privacy. You have a right to participate in society without them asking you to divulge your health information, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said. Okay, DeSantis wasn't really talking about trans athletes. He was talking about vaccine passports. Conservatives are moving to restrict COVID-19 vaccination verification schemes, even if they are imposed by private businesses. It's a tricky issue, but vaccine passport bans can reasonably be seen as infringing on our rights to private property and free association. The Iowa legislature recently finalized a vaccine passport bill, which Reynolds plans to sign. It's a marginalized society, this two-tier society. Either adhere or be marginalized, and that is ridiculous. That is not who we are as Americans, Reynolds said of vaccine passports. Adhere or be marginalized? Imagine how transgender kids feel. The vaccine passport discussion was teed up by a question from the audience. The asker offered an interesting frame. Human beings have a right to free movement and to not have their daily activities infringed upon. Governors nodded along, but within the hour they had forgotten about the right to free movement when they took turns fear-mongering over the surge of migrants at the southern border. Reynolds reiterated that Iowa would not aid migrant children, again calling it President Joe Biden's problem. Free movement except for those people. Governors participated in rounds of one-upmanship, bickering over which one of them loves bloated police budgets and hates big tech the most. The common theme is using state power to impose a specific set of social values. Their idea of freedom is flimsy, dissonant, and plainly un-American. Freedom for some, genital inspections for others. And the Gazette editorial for today, new leadership. The next University of Iowa president comes to position with great challenges, but also one crucial advantage. Barbara Wilson, the number two administrator at the nearby University of Illinois system, this past week was named UI's 22nd president. She is set to take over in July following the retirement of UI President Bruce Harrell this month. Her impressive professional background and the sound process through which she was chosen gave us confidence she can lead the campus through a period of great uncertainty. When she reports to Iowa City to work, Wilson will be greeted by historic challenges at Iowa's flagship public university. Harrell's selection in 2015 was mired in controversy. He was a businessman hired by the Board of Regents despite having no meaningful academic experience. Faculty leaders called it an autocratic process and fundamentally flawed. Harrell's private contacts with Iowa higher education leaders before his hiring gave the impression that he was hand-selected for the job and that the interview process was a sham. Right or wrong, Harrell's presidency was tainted from the start. Wilson, by contrast, comes in with high confidence among students and faculty. She was the top choice among four candidates in feedback to the Board of Regents, earning 80% approval. Survey respondents listed academic leadership experience and crisis management skills among Wilson's positive qualities. Wilson is a Midwesterner, and she's familiar with the culture of Big Ten universities as a University of Wisconsin alum and University of Illinois vice president. She knows how a major research university operates, and that should enable her to make an immediate impact from the president's office. The new president must chart a course to long-term financial sustainability. There are two sides to that equation, securing adequate funding from the state government and also right-sizing university operations to reflect demographic trends. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, UI was facing a grim enrollment outlook. The number of college-bound graduates from Iowa high schools is dwindling. The university's undergraduate enrollment this year is down by more than 1,000 compared to the previous year. Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa are trending the same way. Emerging from the coronavirus pandemic, universities should consider alternative models for education with an emphasis on access and affordability. The college experience can't be replaced wholesale by webinars, but we have learned this past year that virtual services can be an important supplement to in-person activities. Some learners, especially non-traditional students seeking to upgrade their skills, would be better served by more remote offerings. That could also provide an opportunity for institutions to shrink their expensive physical footprints. Building productive relationships will be crucial in the university's next chapter, both on and off campus. Wilson should continue campus leaders' commitment to fostering connections to their peers in Iowa City and beyond. With strong approval from faculty and staff, Wilson already is ahead of her predecessor in that regard. The bigger challenge will be making inroads with state policymakers, who in recent years have overseen a reduction in government support for higher education, which UI leaders call generational divestment. Wilson will attempt what previous leaders failed to do: make a clear and convincing case to the legislature and governor that higher education is a good investment of state dollars. If we have one piece of advice for the new UI president, it's to be transparent. Harrell has often shied away from scrutiny from the public and the press, incompatible with his role as a public official. Being accessible and open to criticism will be a positive attribute, no matter what crises arise. Wilson inherits a damaged institution. With clear priorities and community support, we are confident she can rise to the challenge. And turning to the community letters and also the editorial cartoon, which today is from Joe Heller of Green Bay. The top of the cartoon is labeled Mother's Day. There are three panels, and the panel on the left is labeled 2020, and Mom is standing behind a window with Mom, Dad, and grandson waving at her through the window. Mom has a sad look on her face. 2021, Mom is no longer separated. She is hugging her children and grandchild. And 2022 in the right-hand panel is a duplicate of the middle panel. Mom, Grandma is still hugging children and grandchild. And the mail says, "You can let us go now." The first letter today is from Alice Dell of Cedar Rapids. Ernst should support protections for all. Thanks to Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley for supporting Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's bill intended to reduce sexual assault in the military. Proposed legislation would take the decision to prosecute an alleged sexual assault out of the military chain of command and give this responsibility to an independent military prosecutor. Ernst, a former military commander and survivor of sexual assault, opposed this legislation when it was introduced. However, despite assurances from the Defense Department that sexual assault in the military would be taken seriously, the incidence has not fallen. Ernst has spoken publicly about the lifelong damaging effects of this crime on survivors and now supports passage of the bill. Other legislation aimed at reducing gender-based violence is the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, which expired and needs to be reauthorized. Last year, when reauthorization was passed in the House, Ernst drafted a competing bill which eliminated a provision recognizing the authority of tribal courts in cases involving assault or murder of Native American and Alaska Native women by non-Native perpetrators. The U.S. Department of Justice reports that Native women are over 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted than U.S. women generally, and 70% of those assaults are committed by non-Natives. Too often, these cases are not prosecuted or the charges are dropped. All women deserve effective legal protection from crimes of violence, and reauthorization of a robust VAWA would be a significant step in the right direction. That was Alice Dahl of Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from Donna Myers of Cedar Rapids. Shame on Reynolds for signing voucher bill. How shameful it is that the new housing law, Senate File 252, signed into law recently by Governor Reynolds, amounts to nothing more than a thinly veiled win for white landlords who now have the authority to legally keep their precious properties lily white. It's as simple as that. Remember the passage from the Bible, Matthew 25:40, "Whatsoever you do to the least of my brethren, you do unto me." Donna Myers of Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from Norman and Donna Barnes of Hiawatha. Don't lock the door and throw out the key. In 1974, a traumatized 13-year-old stepped over our threshold. He had few teeth, didn't hear well, and spoke little English. He struggled, as refugee kids do, learning new customs and laws in a land where people looked like giants and ate strange food. Afraid of starving, he hid bananas under his bed. At night, the horrors of war haunted his dreams. Finding a home in Iowa was the start of a safe new life for him. He worked his way through many jobs, Kirkwood, Camp Wapsie, Cedar Memorial, and Merchants National Bank. By age 16, Kiwanis honored him with a citizenship award. After high school, he kept a 3.4 GPA at Kirkwood in spite of a language difficulty. After graduating, he took a job at Rockwell using their scholarship assistance program to enroll at Mount Mercy. This once frightened refugee kid is now retired from Rockwell. Over time, he has paid thousands of dollars in taxes, contributes to our economy and votes, gives of his time and resources freely. Being his American parents has been a privilege. Thanks to former Governor Ray for saying yes to Vietnamese refugees. They have made Iowa a better place. Thumbs down to Governor Kim Reynolds for saying, no, it's not our problem. FYI, Governor, caring for children in peril is a humanitarian imperative, not a state budgeting or petty tit-for-tat partisan issue. Iowans put the heart in Heartland. Don't lock the door and throw away the key on refugee kids. We are far better than that. Norman and Donna Barnes of Hiawatha. The next letter is from Marcelina Ceniceros of Iowa City. Congress must go bold on economic recovery. In response to President Joe Biden's new economic recovery proposal, I'm pleased he's included resources to increase the supply of affordable housing. However, without expanded rental assistance, low-income renters won't be able to afford such housing. Currently, only one in four eligible renters gets federal rental assistance due to inadequate funding. Congress should expand rental assistance to all eligible renters. This will keep them stably housed, prevent evictions, and prevent homelessness. We must also make permanent recent improvements to the Earned Income Tax Credit and Child Tax Credit. These changes, which expire next year, will benefit 17 million low-wage workers and cut child poverty by 45%. We can create an economy where workers are protected, families are stably housed, and children are allowed to thrive. In upcoming economic recovery legislation, I urge our members of Congress to expand rental assistance to all who qualify and make the EITC and CTC changes permanent. Marcelina Ceniceros of Iowa City. Next, Del Lawrence of Marion writes, free tuition means no skin in the game. Free education. My grandniece received a 2-year Pell Grant to attend Kirkwood Community College and a 529 savings account to pay for her Kirkwood Village apartment. Result, she signed up for 8 courses over 2 semesters and dropped all the courses, so received 0 credits. With no skin in the game, free is a waste. Congress needs to rethink free college tuition. That was Del Lawrence of Marion. And Dwayne Eldred of Urbana writes, where is state bonus money coming from? Citizens of Iowa, I would like to know where this bonus money is coming from that our governor is passing out. Thousands of dollars to those who work for us already. If their salaries are not enough, then have the legislature increase their salaries. Dwayne Eldred of Urbana. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 9th, 2021, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn now to the obituaries. From Palo, Stephen P. Burgeon, age 64, passed away on Thursday, May 6th. Joseph Carpenter, known as Joe, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Friday, May 7th at St. Luke's Hospital in the Hospice Unit. Visitation, 1 to 3 p.m. Tuesday, May 11th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Funeral service will immediately follow at 3 p.m. at the funeral home. Certified celebrant Amy Hart will officiate. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Joe under photos and videos starting at 3 p.m. Tuesday, May 11th. Burial will be held at a later date at Hillcrest Cemetery, Volga, Iowa. Joe married Pam Way on September 6, 1969 in Volga. The couple was married 49 years until Pam's passing. He was a quality control manager at Weyerhaeuser Paper Company for over 25 years until his retirement. Joe belonged to the Hawkeye Hook Setters and was a proud member of the NRA. He was an avid gun and weapons enthusiast and coin collector. He enjoyed fishing and working on his vehicles. Joe liked watching planes take off and land and even began working on obtaining his pilot's license. Joe enjoyed a lot of things in life, but above all, he loved his grandkids. Charlene Sue Clothier, 65, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Springville, Iowa, passed away Friday, May 7th at Evergreen Estates 2 in Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, May 10th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 11th at the funeral home. Burial will take place at Springville Cemetery in Springville. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Charlene was employed at Goodwill Industries and Rockwell in Cedar Rapids. She loved attending family events and gatherings. Charlene also enjoyed playing cards, doing arts and crafts, and other activities with her Evergreen family. She was known as a very giving person. Charlene will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. The Reverend Joan Irby, Mrs. Warren H., age 92, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, May 6th at her home. Private graveside service, 2 p.m. Thursday, May 13th at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Betty J. Hamilton, 75, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, May 4th, at home with her family by her side. A public visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 11th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, with a funeral service to follow at 11 a.m., interment at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Riverside, Iowa. Following the continued proclamations issued by the governor, physical distancing must be practiced, which may require a limited number of people allowed into a visitation at one time, and limited seating available at the services. The use of facial coverings is strongly encouraged. Betty enjoyed attending her children and grandchildren's sporting events and tailgating at Iowa football games. Betty and Chuck liked to travel throughout the continental United States with their children and grandchildren. They took several trips to Hawaii and Mexico. She once won a trip to Switzerland, France, and Italy. One of her favorite trips was to ancestral Ireland to visit family. Ronald Gerard Juergens, known as Scrawny, age 55, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, May 4th. Public visitation will be from 2 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 11th at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Burial will be in St. Paul's Catholic Cemetery in Worthington at 1 p.m. Wednesday, May 12th. Ron will be honored with a motorcycle procession to the cemetery with kickstands up at 11 a.m. sharp Wednesday from Brosh Chapel. The family has asked everyone to wear their favorite romper room or Harley attire to the service. There will be a celebration of life starting at 2 p.m. Saturday, May 15th at Hotel Whiskey, located at 4720 Leprechaun Lane in Cedar Rapids. Ron owned and operated Auto Glass Solutions in Cedar Rapids for nearly 20 years. Scrawny was known as the founder of the Romper Room Ride, which was started in 1990. He enjoyed the freedom of the road and was happy being on his Harley. Scrawny would start out his Fridays with a "You boozin" text to join up at B's to be with Charlie and his friends. He loved being a dad to his children, Carly Chicker and Abe Hammer, and was proud of their achievements. Scrawny and Hammer worked hard but played harder, riding motorcycles and snowmobiles. Clifford Jude Kindle, age 71, of Cedar Rapids, passed away in Mission, Texas on March 31st after a sudden illness, with his family at his side. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. May 15th at St. Ludmilla's Catholic Church, conducted by Father Ken Glazer. The family will greet friends from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the church social hall. The burial will be at St. John's Cemetery Independence at 2 p.m., There will be a reception from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Moose Lodge, 1820 West Post Road, Southwest Cedar Rapids. When Clifford was not working, you could find him camping, canoeing, and fishing on the Volga, Turkey, and Mississippi rivers with his sons, siblings, and friends. He knew these rivers like the back of his hand. He had a wide variety of interests. He was an expert morel mushroom hunter. He worked extensively on woodworking projects and built furniture, collected chalk pastel artwork, and was a prolific reader. Lawrence Lawrence, known as Mike, age 76, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, May 6th at the Views of Marion. Services 10 a.m. Saturday, May 15th at St. Matthew Catholic Church by the Reverend Douglas Loak. Burial, Mount Calvary Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Friday at Tien Funeral Home from 4 to 6 p.m. Per COVID-19 guidelines, attendees are asked to wear masks and practice social distancing. Mike was a U.S. Army veteran serving during the Vietnam War. On December 30th, 1967, he married Carol Skvor at St. Pius Catholic Church. Mike worked at Iowa Manufacturing for 43 years, and he was a member of the Knights of Columbus Council 5390. Petrina Levy, 55, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on May 3rd at the Dennis and Donna Oldhoff Hospice House of Mercy. A celebration of life gathering will be from 10 a.m. until noon Saturday, May 15th at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church, located at 6621 C Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Ross Champlin, the AVA Center in Cedar Rapids, is in charge of arrangements. Jeanette May Manson, born Jeanette May Fox, a service is planned for Jeanette on Sunday, June 20th at 11:30 a.m. at First Presbyterian Church of Mount Vernon with a meal to follow. Jeanette passed away on December 8, 2020 in Ramsey, Minnesota. Daniel Mullen Sr., 57, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Friday, April 30th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Memorial service, 2:30 p.m. Saturday, May 15th at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. Visitation 1 hour prior to the services at the funeral home. Daniel worked in concrete polishing for many years, most recently for Polish Max. He enjoyed working and in his free time would play frisbee, ride his bicycle, or anything outdoors such as camping or fishing. Daniel was a happy and outgoing man who was always there to lend a hand, especially when his kids needed help with cars or moving. Ronald Lee Rogers, 76, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, December 24th in Phoenix, Arizona, following a short illness. Friends made a visit with the family on Friday, May 14th from 4 to 7 p.m. at TN Funeral Home. A private family burial will take place at Olin Cemetery. Ron loved to fish and camp. Following many years of family camping in Iowa, they enjoyed numerous trips with Stephanie and family in the mountains of Idaho, preceded and followed by many days of free camping on the driveway of the Fickles. He also looked forward to the annual Minnesota trips with Linda's siblings and extended families. Ron always had a great sense of humor, a sheepish grin, a twinkle in his eye, and will be forever missed. Ronald G. Franks, known as Bear, age 79, of Marion, passed away Wednesday, April 21st. Please join us for a celebration of life in loving memory of Bear Franks from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, May 15th at the Eagles Club, located at 1735 11th Street Northwest. There will be live music and food. A cash bar will also be available. Norman Sasek of Cedar Rapids, with characteristic sense of dedication, humor, and hard work, Norman Sasek approached life in search of adventure and opportunity. Sadly, his family announces his recent passing. Graveside services are at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 11th at St. John's Cemetery, with Reverend Mark Murphy officiating. Military honors at the cemetery will be provided by the Marion American Legion Post 298. Visitation will be Monday, May 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Papich Cuba Funeral Home East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast, with a vigil service at 5 p.m. Due to COVID-19 considerations, anyone attending is respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Norman and his wife have long felt the importance of giving back, which has inspired his family to continue those efforts. He has been a member of AARP, various coin collector societies, and an avid Chicago Cubs and Iowa Hawkeyes fan. He appreciated the fact that the Cubs won a World Series on his birthday. Tammy D. Vivarka, 57, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, May 5th. A visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Friday, May 14th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch-Linwood in Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Tammy worked at Doc and Eddie's, which she managed with her brother for several years, and then worked at Collins Community Credit Union for 21 years until her retirement in December 2020. She loved Harley-Davidson's and the Raiders. Tammy was an animal lover, especially her Rottweiler Buddy. As her brother said, Tammy was the toughest woman you'd ever meet with the purest heart of gold you could find. She'll be loved and missed by many. Dennis K. Doctorman of Denver, Colorado, died of natural causes on August 28, 2020. He never married and was a lifelong atheist. His body has been donated to medical science. Marjorie Ellen Schaefers, known as Marge, age 84, of Marion, formerly of Center Point, passed away on Wednesday, May 5th at the Views in Marion, surrounded by her loving family. A family vigil service will be held at 4:30 p.m. Monday, May 10th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. A visitation will follow from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 11th at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Walker, Iowa, conducted by the Reverend Jim Brockman. Burial will take place at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Masonville, Iowa. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. A live stream of the funeral mass may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Marge under Photos and Videos or Media starting at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday. Marge was known for her quick-witted humor, having an open mind, and her ability to view things from a variety of perspectives. She shared many bits of wisdom with her family, one of which was to never discuss religion or politics in a social setting. She was proud of her Irish heritage, a fierce and competitive card player, and loved to watch her favorite sports teams, Chicago Cubs, Notre Dame, and Iowa Hawkeyes. Softball was another favorite, as she served as the official scorekeeper for the Center Point Urbana softball team for many years and even played softball herself in high school. David Jerome Hogan, 77, of Uvalde, Texas, passed away very peacefully May 1st at Amistad Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Uvalde after a long, hard-fought battle. There will be a memorial in Iowa at a later date. David attended St. Mary's Catholic School in Manchester through 8th grade. He graduated from West Delaware High School in Manchester, Iowa, in 1962. Dennis Neal Norton, known as Denny or Bullet, age 74, of Hiawatha, passed away on Wednesday, May 5th, as a result of cancer. Mother Gump, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 11th, at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Parish in Hiawatha, officiated by Father Gary Meyer, with a gathering 1 hour prior at the church. A luncheon will follow after the mass. A private burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, per the family. Visitation with the family will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, May 10th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 520 Wilson Avenue in Cedar Rapids. Denny so loved growing up in Anamosa with his Philo Pismeyer friends, primarily Speedy, Paul, Tank, Bill, Easel, Jan, Muskie, Gary, Stud, Alan, Bullet, Denny. They enjoyed getting into mischief, such as riding the bumpers of cars during the winter months, throwing snowballs at cars, turned tomatoes during spring, while on top of most of the downtown buildings of Anamosa, camping by the Wapsie, and just having fun, raising hell. And Lucas Edward Dennis, age 33, of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, formerly of Swisher, passed away on November 28, 2020. As per the family's wishes, private family interment will be in Anderson Cemetery near Swisher. There will be a celebration of life gathering on Sunday, May 16, 2021, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2021 Bowling Street Southwest. Lucas graduated from Cedar Rapids Prairie High School, class of 2006. He was united in marriage to Brittany Anderson on January 11, 2014. Turning now to the sports section, Colonel's back in business, front office putting in 12-hour days, by Casey Drotter, correspondent. For a little more than 1,700 fans in attendance, Tuesday's Cedar Rapids Colonel's season opener represented the much-needed return of minor league baseball and a sense of normalcy. For members of the team's front office, it was a culmination of one of the most stressful months of their lives. Over the last 30 days, the front office staff has put in at least 12-hour days, at least 6 days a week, Colonel's GM Scott Wilson said. You're putting up signs, cleaning, running a pressure washer for 8 hours a day to try and get things done. It's not things that all of us were used to, because there were normally employees here that were doing that for us. Such is the life for the Cedar Rapids front office. The full-time staff is half of what it used to be, pared down to just 7 members after last June's pandemic-driven layoffs. Those who remain are spending the 2021 season managing their responsibilities and those of the employees no longer on hand. We're just piecing it together right now, said Andrea Brommelkamp, the Colonel's senior director of tickets and group sales. We're missing a lot of salespeople. We also are missing a graphics person. We're missing a concessions hiring manager. We're all working super hard just to make sure that fans don't see any of those gaps. The Colonel's staff effectively accomplished that mission Tuesday night. Ticket takers gleefully welcomed fans back to Veterans Memorial Stadium for the first time since 2019. The Hot Corner Grill served hot, long lines all night long. The smiles of attendees were hard to miss, even when hidden under masks and face coverings. It was an impressive feat considering how few full-time workers were on hand to pull it off. Unfortunately, their nights of wearing many hats won't be going anywhere anytime soon. While the $1.4 million loan the city helped the team secure in October can keep things afloat, COVID capacity restrictions hinder any chances of rehiring former staff. The Colonels also have struggled to find enough food and concessions workers, battling a combination of non-competitive wages and still remaining COVID concerns. There's hope, however, that this won't be a season-long issue. I really am optimistic about it, Brommelkamp said of boosting the team's concession staff. I think that we have a very legitimate and safe plan in place to keep not only our fans safe, but also our employees. It's another hurdle for the Colonels' halved front staff to handle. But after the month they've endured to get to this point, they're fully prepared to face just about any adversity thrown their way. Everyone has just picked up the ball, working that much harder just to make it through, CEO Doug Nelson said. Every day is a new challenge. It's a very dynamic situation. We have learned how to change up and move on a dime. As for staffing the concession stands, if you're looking for a position, we'd happily take your application. Some local sports notes. College baseball. Hawkeyes split with Nittany Lions. Iowa split a twin bill with Penn State on Saturday, winning 5-3 before falling 5-4 at Banks Field. Starter Duncan David improved to 4-1 after 5 strong innings in the opener. In the nightcap, Brendan Shear was thrown out at home plate for the final out. It is good to win the series, Iowa coach Rick Heller said. It's tough right now. You have a chance to tie the game, and their outfielder makes a great play with a wet ball and makes a perfect throw. Soccer. Cedar Rapids Inferno opens 2021 season today in Joliet, Illinois. The Cedar Rapids Inferno opens the 2021 season today against the Steel City FC at Joliet Slammer Stadium at 7:45 p.m.
The Inferno are part of the Midwest Premier League West Division, which includes 12 teams in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa. Wolfpack ends a Cyclones run in college tennis in Raleigh, North Carolina. A day after earning the program's first NCAA tournament win, the Iowa State women's tennis team bowed out, falling to number 6 North Carolina State 4-2. ISU finished the best season in school history with a 14-8 record. Thassapour Naklo upset number 6 Anna Rogers 6-3, 6-1 at number 1 singles. It is the highest-ranked player any Cyclone has ever defeated. Iowa State freshman Miska Kadlakova added a 6-3, 6-4 win at number 3 singles. Despite losing at number 2 singles, ISU senior Maddie Cancini closed her career as the school's career wins leader with 160. College softball, no-hitter Grand Slam carry UNI in Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa swept Southern Illinois 7-5 and 1-0 on Saturday at Robinson Dresser Sports Complex. In the second game, Kaylin Packard pitched a no-hitter for UNI 21-17. She had 9 strikeouts. In the opener, Emmy Wills hit a grand slam in the bottom of the 6th inning. And Ochoa leads ISU past Kansas 5-4 in Lawrence, Kansas. A day after getting coach Jamie Pinkerton his 100th win at Iowa State, the Cyclones got him number 101, beating Kansas 5-4 at Orocha Ballpark. Malaysia Ochoa had a home run, a double, and 2 RBIs to lead a 10-hit attack for ISU 30-19. And Iowans in the NMLB, Angels outright Schebler to AAA. In Salt Lake City, former Prairie Star Scott Schebler was sent outright by the Los Angeles Angels to the Salt Lake Bees, a AAA West. Schebler had 4 hits and 27 plate appearances for the Angels with 11 strikeouts and no walks. The Time Machine section of in the Iowa Today look back at people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Julian Dubuque, Iowa's first white settler, worked as a trader, miner, and married a Meskwaki chief's daughter, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. French-Canadian Julian Dubuque is credited with being Iowa's first white settler. It took almost 70 years after his death before a landmark monument was built over his gravesite near the eastern Iowa city that bears his name. Dubuque arrived in northeast Iowa around 1788, living among the Meskwaki, called Fox by the French, in Little Fox Village. He was repeatedly charismatic and became a close friend of Meskwaki chief Piasta, and eventually marrying Piasta's daughter Potosa. Through his association with the tribe, Dubuque discovered the abundance of lead ore in the bluffs and valleys west of the Mississippi River that the Indians until then had kept secret. He soon gained permission from the tribe to mine the lead. To cover his bases, Dubuque also obtained permission in 1796 from the governor of the Spanish province of Louisiana, Baron Carondelet, to take ore from the mines of Spain in a 50-square-mile area of the Spanish-held territory. Dubuque continued working in the mines and as a trader for more than 20 years until he died March 24, 1810. He was buried with tribal honors before native chiefs and hundreds of men and women who climbed to his burial place atop a bluff overlooking the Mississippi River. In an 1833 public meeting, the village near where Dubuque mined was named after him, honoring him as the area's first pioneer. His gravesite was difficult to access and was mostly ignored. The editor of the Milwaukee Sentinel, however, visited the grave in 1849. "We found the tomb made of stone under a lofty bluff just below the city," he reported. "It had a leaden door with a wooden cross on it and the inscription, 'Julian Dubuque, miner of the mines of Spain, died 24th day of March, 1810, age 45 years, 6 months.'" The effort to erect a memorial to Dubuque began in 1858. In 1870, the old settlers of the area were still contemplating a monument. One of those settlers, Eliphalet Price, visited Dubuque's grave in 1834 and 1835, reporting it had a commanding view of the Mississippi River. "The exterior of the building was about 8 feet by 10, he said. "The walls were of stone at about 12 inches in thickness. The roof of the building was combed and covered with cedar shingles, its length being parallel with the Mississippi River. At the north end of the building, about 3 feet from the ground, was an opening into the interior about 2 feet square. There was no door or doorframe or woodwork of any kind about the jambs." Price was determined to examine the vault. He grabbed a makeshift tool, crawled in, and began digging in the dirt until he unearthed human skeletal remains, as well as those of bear, raccoon, and deer, along with buttons, beads, and shells. By 1845, though, between vandals and the weather, the structure had lopped its roof, its red cedar cross, and about a foot of wall. On September 27, 1897, the Early Settlers Association, the Iowa Institute of Science and Arts, and contractor Carter Brothers began working on a monument to mark Dubuque's grave. The circular, castle-like structure was built of native limestone. It was 25 feet tall and 12 feet in diameter. The entrance to the grave at the base was secured by a grating. When construction began, workers were surprised to unearth multiple skeletons. It was commonly believed the grave had been looted long before. Those buried there besides Dubuque were Chief Piasta, Chief Rolling Cloud, Gray Eagle, and Dubuque's wife, Potosa. The bones were removed, and those identified as Dubuque's were reinterred before the monument was dedicated October 31, 1897. Potosa's remains and those of her father, Chief Piasta, were placed in museums until 1973, when Piasta was buried near Dubuque's monument. What happened to Potosa's remains is unknown. the mines of Spain were abandoned in the early 1900s. The Iowa Conservation Commission acquired the site in 1982. The State Mines of Spain Recreation Area today covers 1,437 acres of woods and prairie land and includes the Julian Dubuque Monument. The area is a National Historic Landmark. And that brings us to the end of the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 9th, 2021. I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto. I have enjoyed reading for you. I hope you've enjoyed listening. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS programming at any time on our website, www.iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.